I solemnly swear that I will tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So help me.
Hi, everybody. Ron here from The Truth About Addiction. Welcome to our podcast. And today we've got a special guest on, Braden Tonks. And Tonks, he's got his own media company, does his own podcast. So welcome to The Truth About Addiction, brother.
Ronnie, thanks for having me, mate. What a bloody honour it is to be a guest on your show, mate. Yeah, let's get into it, bro.
Yeah, mate. What's your story, brother? Please tell us the Braden story.
Well, mate, so I'm the eldest of four. I grew up in a suburb north of Hobart in Tasmania by the name of Claremont, housing commission area. We weren't the richest family, but you know, parents had their ways of making money, you know, so we definitely weren't the poorest either, you know. From the age of, from birth till about 12 was pretty rough, you know, a lot of domestic violence, whatnot, you know, just the usual sort of what you expect from a family from that sort of background. Around the age of 12, mum and dad split up, due to domestic violence, and my mum picked up a pretty hectic drug habit. Back then, it was the old school speed.
Yeah, right.
When her and dad split, she sort of went down an ugly path, mate, and for pretty much the next 20 years, dad was an angry man. He come from a hard town, northern suburbs of Hobart there, by the name of Norfolk. He was, raised by his mum and his alcoholic stepfather, lots of beltons, things like that, growing up. Yeah, his stepfather had a very notorious word reputation as a violent pub fighter, you know, and that sort of bred into me, dad. I didn't know any different, mate. By the age of, 15, I was drinking in pubs with dad, following in his footsteps. It sort of went down the line, you know, getting into pub fights every weekend, punching on with, you know, guys his age when I'm this 15-year-old kid, not even old enough to be in the pub. I always got away with it, you know, but that went on, mate, right up until I was like 18, 19, 20, hitting the nightclubs in Hobart, cut a long story short, I ended up with life bans throughout all the nightclubs. On top of all the fighting and shit that I used to do, I was started to get into, selling ecstasy and mainly ecstasy around that time, because in Tasmania, as you'll hear further along, my drug of choice was ice. But back in those days, ice wasn't around in Tassie, you know. It didn't sort of, I was around the age of 23 when ice sort of hit the streets of Tassie and shit started going sour. But sort of before that, you know, I was going out with, 300-500 pingers, as we call them, ecstasy tablets, going home with, $5,000-$6,000 cash in my pockets every night and some busted fists and a fucking blood nose, you know, every weekend without a doubt. It faded away a little bit. I'd triple drop these pills, mate, three times a night on a Friday and a Saturday. So we're talking like 20 pingers over the course of the weekend, every weekend, obviously that fueled a lot of the violent side of me, I suppose. I went to school with her actually, but we got together, the mother of my two eldest daughters. I met her, about the age of 16. So she sort of was there through a lot of the drug dealing side of stage of my life. And then we had our first daughter when I was 19, Amali, God bless her. So then we ended up going on to have another daughter when I was 21. I suppose that's what sort of led me away from that town, that party nightclub life until, the ice sort of hit Tasmania, mate. And, you can pretty much throw all what I've just told you out the window when that hit, mate. There was no warning signs of, this shit will ruin your family. This will, there was none of that. It was just, you can put this stuff in a pipe, light it up and smoke it like a bong, you know, and then feel like you're high on speed. It's cool, you know. Little did I know, mate, 7 years later, I'd be fucking an absolute shell of myself and, you know, yeah, gone off the rails big time, prison under my belt and stuff. But anyway, yeah, that's how it started, Ron. I started to smoke the pipe around the age of 23. Within 6 months' time of everyday use, mate, and like I said, there was no warning that it was this bad thing like there is today, you know, which was a shame, you know, because I probably wouldn't have went down the path I did with it, you know. But yeah, about 6 months into it, mate, I've lost, you know, 15 kilos. The kid's mother had no idea what was sort of going on with me. She had a fair idea I was abusing something, like, but you know, mate, I'd have meltdowns when I'd be coming off it, you know, after a few days. 3-4 days awake, excuse me. I'd have these meltdowns run where I fucking go off my head, and you know, obviously with the violent sort of nature that I had as well, you know, not physically towards her at all, but I'd kick holes in the fucking walls, and I'd bawl my eyes out, and I mean, there was a few occasions, mate, where I'd, you know, she'd be crying with a baby in her arms, and I'd be out the back with a fucking rope, climbed up the tree in the backyard, threatening, I was never going to do it, but threatening to her that I'm going to jump out and hang myself, you know, just because all these emotions of coming down off this drug that, you know, there was no, like I said, there was no previous warning to it. It was this new thing in Tassie. Mate, she packed up and left me, yeah, when I was 23, and mate, that fully broke me, you know. I had a 2-year-old and a 6-month-old, 2 little girls, you know, both in nappies still, and mate, like I said, I got with her when I was 16. I didn't even know how to use a fucking washing machine by myself, you know. And then here I am, I'm left sort of on my own. I rented a room underneath my uncle's house, and it was just so hard to accept the fact that I had caused all this, and now I had to deal with it, you know. Yeah, so anyway, I cleaned myself up, Ron. I didn't touch that drug again for 3 years, around about 3 years. Fully clean, you know. Obviously, in the first stage of our breakup, I've done anything I could to try and win her back over, you know. But obviously, she moved on with her life, which she ended up going on to live a good and happy life, you know. So bless her. But I ended up finding my feet, you know, got. Because obviously when I'd got on it for that 6 months and ruled myself for that first time, I gave my job up. You know, I'm a sheet metal worker by trade, so I had a good job, you know, well-paid job. We had a nice house, everything like that. But I gave work up, you know. It ate me alive that first 6 months. But, yeah, so I got back into work, finally landed my own place, you know. I'm about 24 now, 25. My own little place for me and my daughters. I'm having the kids, you know, week on, week off. You know, I found another partner, which she didn't stick around too long, but I was happy, you know, I was happy. But, mate, there come this one day, you know, where I don't know what it was. Like, and mind you, and then I can speak freely about this because I've been caught for everything I'll tell you now, so it's not like I'm hiding anything from the police or anything, but... You know, I'd got my own place and I'd started growing a bit of dope, a bit of marijuana, you know. So I had a steady income from working. I had, you know, a bit of play money from growing the pot. And this one day, mate, it just come over me. Obviously, where I'd got my house was a pretty drug filled area, in Tassie, Chigwell. People that watch this from Tassie will know Chigwell. It's, yeah, pretty of a down, rougher sort of area, you know. But I was happy, mate. I had my beautiful little house with my kids and whatnot. And I had money and I was happy. But anyway, there's come this time, obviously there was a few guys that were hanging around, and, you know, ice was a big thing still, and I was still so afraid of it. You know, I was like, fuck, you know. And I'd only experienced 6 months on it in the past, you know. It was enough to scare me away from it for those few years. But, yeah, there come this time, and this bloke... He used to blow glass pipes and sell a bit of ice, you know. And I don't know what it was. think he may have come and got a bit of weed off me one time and had it. I was like, oh, fuck it. Could it do me up a point and I'll get a pipe off you as well. I just thought I'll just do it by myself. And I remember sitting there in the laundry by myself and I had this pipe. And mate, it was like all the hairs on my head stood up, my scalp went tight, like the whole, you know, and that was it, mate. I was stuck on it then for the next, 5 years after that. Next 6 years, sorry. Yeah, and that went from, you know, obviously I could deal drugs, I was dealing pot. So that I thought, you know, rather than pay for this stuff, I'm going to, started just getting, you know, half an eight ball at a time, selling enough to support my own habit. That went to pretty quickly to, you know, an eight ball to, next thing you know, I'm flying back and forth to Melbourne and importing it back in undies, 5, 6, 7 ounces at a time, and selling my own ounces. So over the course of, I think, 2 to 3, maybe 4 months, I'd went from, yeah, a half an eight ball to selling my own ounces. And so I did it. I did it 4 weeks in a row. Like I said, but I was bringing 5 ounces back at a time and then 6 and then 7. And it come the fifth week I went to do it. And I was kissed on the dick by a fairy this day, mate. It was the guy, my connection in Melbourne, he was in Sydney and, you know, he wasn't going to be back in time for the to do the transaction stuff. I had a flight booked and so I was like, fuck, I'll have to come back over tomorrow, you know, or the next day and do it. So I've jumped back on the flight back to Hobart and, you know, and look, Ron, I used to just do it and it was through the hotter weather stage of the year. I used to just do it in a singlet, you know, loose shorts, and I'd wear, you know, four or five pairs of undies just to keep it real tight and compact around the groin area, you know, and just be casual as, you know, and just have a backpack. Well, mate, I've jumped on that. That's another thing too. I used to make sure I'd always get the front seat of the plane and the front row of the plane and seat C. So I was the aisle seat. So I was the first one off the plane every time, you know. And I, anyway, mate, we've touched down in Hobart this time and I was guilty, you know. I was thinking, fuck, I've let this bloke down. I had all these deals lined up. You know, I had, I'd just flown back with no drugs, but I had $20,000 cash on me, obviously what I was going to use to buy the stuff over there. Anyway, I've touched down in Hobart. I'm walking off the plane and I don't know if you've been to Hobart, but it's just you're walking straight along the tarmac into the airport. As I'm walking off, I'm the first one off, obviously, and I can see usually there'll be, you know, somebody from the airport guiding me, yeah, walk this way, down this path, you know. This guy doesn't look like he works at the airport, you know. It was like, nah, something's sus here. And I was just walking closer and closer to him, mate. And as I got closer, another bloke stepped out and they've grabbed me. They said to me, I still remember it clear as day. He said to me, because I was straight on the defensive, you know. I was this cocky fucking drug dealer that thought his fucking shit didn't stink, mate. My head was this big. I had all the money, the assets, you know, like, you know, it goes. Anyway, he's grabbed me. And I said, what the fuck? Don't fucking touch me, you know. And I knew I had no drugs on me. So I was just cocky as I was. Don't fucking touch me. And he's like, mate, you can either keep walking with us and not make a scene or I can fucking arrest you right here. I was like, whatever. And he's walked me. I didn't even make it into the airport. He's walked me into this little side door, which went into this half-renovated room in the airport. And mate, their excuse was that I had a warrant from failure to appear to court. But I later on found out that it was, you know, someone that I'd been trying to help me hook up to another hookup in Melbourne. I ended up getting dobbed in, you know, obviously. Anyway, they've taken me into this half-renovated room and I fully strip-searched me. You know, I'd never even been strip-searched like this in jail. It was like the whole pull the foreskin back, like the whole, you know, and I had $10,000 cash, you know, you can travel with $10,000 cash. So I had a $10,000 brick rubber banded up in my backpack and I had $5,000 in each shoe, like just, you know, just to sort of hide it a bit. And I've Yeah, they've obviously seen the cash and they found a couple of empty satchels, you know, in my bag, and that was enough for them to arrest me and take my phone. And in my phone, mate, was everything. You know, everything. They'd seen everything. But cut a long story short, I was taken back, you know, interviewed, all the bullshit, and given they were either going to, because this was a nighttime flight, they were either going to, you know, keep me locked up for the night and get a warrant to search my house, or if I give them permission to search my house, they'd let me out, that bail me that night, you know. So I was like, well, I'd been in Melbourne for the last 5 days, and I had a housemate that was looking after the place, and he was cooked and very well known to the police as well. I said, well, you know, mate, you're more than welcome to search my house. You know, I was really run. All I wanted was another hit. I hadn't had a hit in over 48 hours, you know. So I was like fucking hanging out big time. And anyway, so they've got back to my house. By the time we got to my house, there'd been another pair of detectives that had already searched the house. They'd taken my security system, you know, the camera system, and whatnot. And anyway, so I've let these coppers go through, and you know, they've found all up. They got me with the grow room, you know, about, I just sold a crop, so it was all just off trimmings, you know, stems and leaves and stuff from the dope crop. There was all up about a pound of off trimmings there that they done me with, and a tick list that the old mate had ripped up and thrown into the toilet, you know. So they've scraped this out of the toilet and put it back together like a puzzle and seen the list of people and whatnot. But cut a long story short, mate, I was, from that day on, like, obviously I didn't have to go to court for, you know, the next couple of months or whatever. So I was on bail, and, mate, I hit it so hard. Throughout that time of just rewind it back a little bit, throughout that time of doing the drug trips back and forth, I started to use needles. Mate, from smoking the pipe to using the needle, it's like two different drugs. It's fucking hectic. But I am, my paranoia, my psychosis is starting to rise. You know, I'm, every single white SUV that I was seeing in Tasmania was these cops that got me at the airport, and I was riding a big high horsepower road bike around at the time too. So I'm fucking absolute lunatic off my head, and weaving in and out of cars, thinking the cops are chasing me and this and that. And so I ended up like packing up and moving to Melbourne to be with this girl. Cut a long story short again, I ended up coming back to Hobart for court. And obviously it was a first offence. I'd never really been in trouble with the cops at this stage. I'd been caught driving, you know, like not even DUIs, just minor traffic offences and stuff. I never ever had a criminal record. So I really got a slap on the wrist. I got a 12-month suspended sentence and, you know, a huge fine and this and that. I was all wholly suspended, my sentence. So I didn't go to jail, but I had this 12-month suspended sentence hanging over my head for the next 3 years. So a 3-year good behaviour bond on top of it, you know. And I moved to Melbourne. And, you know, and we were clean for the first few months, cleaned ourselves up, and then we both started to get on it hard over there, me and her. And, you know, I kept in contact with this guy that I was getting it off originally over there and stuff. So I had unlimited amounts of it. But we ended up, I ended up having some of the most craziest psychosis moments over there. You know, we'd have arguments and I'd just piss off and go driving by myself for days around Victoria, you know, just on the peak, on the paranoid peak. But I'd come back to Tassie to see my kids one weekend, and I was staying with my dad, and, you know, I had this ugly feeling in my belly that she was doing the dirty and that, you know. I had no proof, but I just had this feeling, you know, just something was up. And I'd done the whole stalker thing, mate, and hacked into her social media and had a look. And anyway, I seen literally 2 days before I did this, so the day I'd flown to Tassie to see the kids, there was a photo of her with this guy that I was originally getting these answers off. You know, he's laying back on the bed with his old fella out, and on our bed, you could see in the background of this photo, there was my clothes and all hanging in the wardrobe. So, you know, this ugly gut feeling was real, you know. Anyway, so me being me, I was like, fuck this, you know, I'm on the next fucking flight over there, I'm going to kill this guy, rah, rah. And my old man was like, and this guy was a part of a Lebo gang sort of in Melbourne too, in Coburg. And the old man was like, you're not fucking going back over there, mate. Like, look at the stadium. I know what you're capable of. That, you know, they'll end up killing you. Like, you know, it was, and they would have, mate. You know, I was just this maniac that would have fucking done, you know, anything to sort of get revenge. Anyway, I left it, mate. I left it 3 weeks. It was about 3 weeks before I went back over. So I was clean for these 3 weeks. Obviously, my old man was, he's very, very anti-drug. You know, as kids, we couldn't even go to the beach wearing flip-flops, you know, in case there was a dirty needle or, like, so he was always like that with drugs. But, so I was clean living with him, you know. I went back 3 weeks later with a straight head, and, mate, I got there, and our whole house was packed up. All my stuff was there. Everything was there, but she was nowhere to be seen. And, so, you know, I'd done the rounds. I won't sort of say too much, but I got revenge on this guy in a sly, secretive play and got away with it. So, but I won't say too much there. But I ended up seeing a newspaper clipping a couple of months later about it. So I ended up just over the next couple of weeks in Melbourne, I sold all my shit off and, you know, I linked up with this guy in Black Ballarat that was a heavy junkie. You know, when we're like that, we call ourselves junkies, I suppose. But he was heavily a heavy IV user, and yeah, ended up falling back into the trap again. Dad was like, you know, get on a fucking plane and get back here. You know, you need help. Didn't go that way. I didn't really get the help from Dad that I was expecting, or well, maybe I'll rephrase that. I didn't want the help. I wasn't ready to give up. I, funnily enough, was reached out to by, still to this day, he's a good, he's a brother of mine. He's part of a motorcycle club. And he reached out to me and he said, you know, there's been this chapter of this bike club that just started up in Hobart. And he's like, he was living at their clubhouse, beautiful, big fucking warehouse, all done out, you know. And he's like, man, I can see the stadium, you know, you're more than welcome to come and come here, you know, we'll clean you up. So I was like, I can jump to this. I'd always had this fascination for Harleys, and you know, my old man builds, still to this day, builds custom choppers for a living, you know. So I was, had this fascination for Harleys and bike clubs, you know. I love that outlaw lifestyle, and you know, but obviously with all that comes the drugs and the drug dealing and all that, you know. So yeah, it didn't sort of go to plan. I moved into this clubhouse and, you know, they took me under their wing, and I believe it wasn't my mate who was part of the club. It wasn't his problem, but it was, all he wanted to do was help me. But I believe it was, you know, more senior members of the club that wanted me part of it because I had this reputation that I could move drugs, mate, like there's no tomorrow in Tassie, you know. I had this rep. You know, if I had it, I could rake in money fast, you know. So I believe it, still to this day, I believe that was part of the reason why they wanted me around, hanging around the club, you know. But I ended up being a part of that for about 6 months, and getting heavy back into dealing it again, mate. And, you know, I was back to my old ways. And then there came this day, mate, obviously I won't go into it too much because it's club business and stuff, but let's just say there was an in-club war, you know, a chapter versus chapter sort of war, and I got stuck into the middle of it. Cut a long story short, we went to this house, this guy's house, this day, this senior member's house, and yeah, there was a group of them there that there was four of us that went there, and there was a group of them there that surrounded us with knives, and you know, I got the whole pistol whipped to the head and the gun put to my face, and mate, I shit you not, and I'm not afraid to say it, I literally still to this day don't think I've hit myself so hard before, you know. I scared the fuck out of me. It was like I had this whole big flash in front of my eyes, like, what are you doing? You know, my kids, this and that. It was like I literally thought I was going to die this day. But yeah, anyway, from that day, we ended up, you know, there was a bit of a promotion and a bit of a fight, but there was no serious wounding or anything like that that happened. We ended up, our crew ended up back at the clubhouse, and I just was like, fuck this, I'm done. I said, I'm sorry, guys, but I'm done. I've got kids, and I walked away, you know, and I walked away with my head held high, with, you know, the acceptance of the senior members and stuff too. It was like, they seen how much it traumatized me, I think, you know. It still makes me get all giddy thinking of it. It was a serious day this day. It was fucking scared the shit out of me. But I ended up going downhill really, really bad from there, mate. Like, I thought I'd seen the worst of it already, but this is when it went downhill real bad. My habit had gotten worse than ever. You know, I was having 3-point shots 3-4 times a day, you know, and I ended up fully homeless. I was like, you know, I hung around these very, very low income housing commission set of flats in the suburb of Glenorchy in Hobart. They were rough, mate. Like, these flats were rough. There was schizophrenic people that lived in them, and you know, the worst of the worst drug addicts. And I'd gone from, you know, I was right up here with the drug dealing, and, you know, dealing with tens of thousand dollars a day, to now literally sitting there hoping to find a little rock on the carpet to use, you know. And, you know, I sort of couch surfed around these flats for a bit, mate, and I never was even receiving a Centrelink benefit, because I was too paranoid to go in and get put on the dole. It was just, you know, so what I was doing, mate, there was a couple of, you know, young guys that was going around stealing people's mountain bikes. And I'd swap them a little bit of this or a little bit of that for a stolen mountain bike. And then I'd build this one cool mountain bike out of these few mountain bikes and sell it legitly to somebody on social media or whatever. And then I'd have money to be able to go and buy, you know, a chunk of ice, or money to be able to go and play the pokies. That was another thing. I got hooked on the pokies. The saddest probably part of my life, I think, was those couple of years there where I was homeless. I didn't see my kids for fucking knows how long. Then I met this other girl, mate. She'd just got out of jail for armed robbery. So I moved in with her, mate, and we just had the most toxic, drug-fueled relationship. She attacked me with a knife, and, you know, I've got scars all up my arm. So we ended up with, you know, AVOs, and that was the end of it with her. I went to, you know, from my dad's house to my brother's house to my uncle's house over the next couple of weeks. Sorry, I ended up, yeah, giving in to this girl this again one more time, and I went back down there. And mate, I was absolutely exhausted. We'd both fallen asleep in bed this night. And next thing I wake up to about 8 police surrounding me in the bedroom. You know, you're under arrest, Mr. Tonks. We've got you, mate. We got you now. You're coming with us now, you know. And yeah, that was the start of my jail journey, mate. So I was locked up in the Hobart Remand Centre, which is in the actual city of Hobart in the CBD, which is joined to the courthouse, you know, where they sort of keep you on remand before they send you over to Risdon Prison. I was there for about a week, and then I was sent over to Risdon Prison, still on remand though, which was funny and weird at the time, but I was still on remand. And, you know, I remember that day, you know, I sort of just, got settled in at the remand centre, and then they come up and they said, "Oh, Mr. Tonks, pack your stuff. You're going over the river." You know, which if you're from Tassie, you know that means you're going to jail. You're going over the river. And yeah, I shit myself. I thought, "Fuck, it's actually really happening. I'm actually going to jail." It's, you know, and anyway, mate, I remember the whole, you know, prison van ride over there, and then driving into the gates and that, and obviously being part of this bike club and stuff, mate, you know, like there was rival bike clubs members in the jail and stuff. So I was intimidated as all hell, you know. And I remember Dad saying to me while I was on the run for that 2 weeks, you know, Dad saying, you know, when they do get you, you know, don't be fucking scared. When you walk in there, he goes, "Mate, if anything starts on you, anything like that, just go off like a fucking helicopter. Punch anyone in arm's reach and make them know that you're not you're not going to be stood over, you know." So that was my first thought thrown in my head, was like, "Fuck, it's about to happen. I'm about to walk into this jail. It's about to be on. You know, I'm a shell of myself. I'm this fucking scrawny little lanky guy, you know, that was just a broken mess, you know." And anyway, I jumped off the prison van, and all the prisoners are all standing there at the, you know, checking out the new meat that's coming in the prison. And I sort of jumped off. When you go in the little introduction part, they give you your prison clothes and your blankets and this and that, you know, how it works. And then they walk you to your cell. And as I walked in, mate, I was sort of, like I said, I'm on edge thinking it's about to happen. But first bloke, "Hey, Tonksy, hey, Nellan, hey, Tonksy." It's like, "Oh, fuck, this is better than the Hobart Remand Centre." And mate, I ended up doing my prison very easy. And I was like, you know, expecting this 12 months. I'd settled in and had accepted I was going to be doing a year, and it was all good, you know. And I got there and I've got a good judge this day. And mate, they said, "Look, you know, you've done everything right in prison." I wasn't a hero. I wasn't a standover. I'd done everything good. I had a positive nature in there. And they said, "Look, we're going to resuspend the rest of your sentence and let you out in a week." And I remember thinking, fuck, I don't want to get out. Anyway, I went back to the yard, back to the jail, back to the yard, and told the boys, you know, I'm out next week. Like, there was a few of them that was, you know, "Oh, what have you done to get out?" You know, none of that bullshit, you know. I was let out, mate, and I remember the first thing, because I didn't have any visitors or anything while I was in jail, apart from, because it was through COVID and stuff too. So, I mean, like my sister and stuff done Zoom calls like this and stuff while I was in there, and I had a couple of visits with her boyfriend, but I hadn't spoke to Dad. I'd spoke to him on the phone a couple of times. I hadn't seen him or anything like that. I was expecting to be able to, you know, just get out, him see me clean and stuff, and then be able to just go and live with him until I find my feet and stuff. Well, it didn't really work out that way, you know. He's got a new partner and stuff at this stage, and it just wasn't, I wasn't a comfortable, like, don't get me wrong, I love my daddy and I know he loves me, but it wasn't a comfortable environment living with him when I got out. So, but he picked me up from jail, and I'd gone back and stayed with him for about a week. I didn't use at all. I didn't even smoke a cigarette, still haven't smoked a cigarette to this day. This is like 3.5 years ago now, but I started to, you know, hit the Hobart CBD up again of a weekend, and just have a drink and, you know, mingle with girls and stuff again. And mate, I'd been out for 2 weeks. This is a funny story. I still joke with the missus about it now. She came, my missus now, mate, she never in a thousand years did I expect to ever meet somebody or have somebody of her nature love me. And she was this half-pissed girl out the front of this club, and she's come up to me and was, I remember you. You're the guy that used to fight and, you know, and sell drugs back in the day. And, you know, and I was like, yeah, no, that ain't me. Sorry, darling, not anymore, you know. And mind you, I've got all this weight back on me where I've been in jail. And she's like, anyway, we clicked, you know, we clicked. I told her I'd just got out of jail. I'd been out for a few months. I'd been out for 2 weeks, though. So we laugh about that. But we kicked it off, mate. She's got a government job. She drove a nice car, and like, that's nothing what I just came from before jail, you know. I came from this horrible toxic drug fueled relationship. Anyway, yeah, met this girl and we kicked it off, mate. And I thought I was fucking, you know, living the dream. And you know, we both would started to, you know, use a little bit of cocaine and just on occasions, you know, we'd have a few lines here and there. And this guy that I was getting cocaine through, he threw an opportunity at me to you know, push a bit of it and make a bit of money. And I was like, fucking, yeah, cool. I just jumped straight back into it, didn't I? This time it's cocaine. This one day she's at work and I go and, I knew a bloke just up in the suburb where I used to live with a bit of ice. And I thought, oh, I'm just going to have one shot, you know, just one point, one shot. And it started again. Not as hectic, nowhere near as hectic as the past. It was because it was a hiding it from her sort of thing, you know. I hid it from her for a few months, you know. I mean, I was probably using it 2-3 times a week, you know, just a one of a morning. And then I'd be lucky to get to sleep by midnight that night, you know, and be able to hide it. It got more and more, you know, she clicked on to what was happening. I took it for granted, you know. I knew she wasn't going to leave me, so I thought, oh, I can get away with it again, you know. Mate, it got to the stage where one night she said, I'm going. I've booked flights. Look, my bag's packed there. I'm going to Darwin. She's got family up in Darwin. And I was like, fuck off, you know, you're not going to fucking leave me. Yeah, fair enough, mate. She did it, packed up and left. And that was the biggest kick in the guts. Like I said, I'd never had a girl of this quality in my life before that loved me the way she did. Within 3 weeks of her leaving, mate, I went hard, real hard. Like, thought, fuck this, I'm going to just send myself back down that path, you know, to try and cover the pain from her leaving me and stuff. But then, you know, come 3 weeks in, and I mean, I probably slept a few hours within that 3 weeks, you know. I was an absolute fucking zombie. I hopped on a plane to the Gold Coast, mate, about 3 weeks after she left me. And yeah, my mum lives up here. So my mum is 3 years into recovery now. Mum is. I mean, I didn't really speak about her too much through there, but she's somebody like yourself that has lived a very, very hectic drug addiction, you know, for a lot of years. And but she's an absolute miracle. Never in my life did I expect my mum be the one to help me, you know. It was like, you know, if I rewind back a little bit, mate, at one stage, she weren't even a mother to me. She was a customer, you know. She was. I used to give her drugs because she would shoplift stuff for me, and you know, and things like that. So never in a lifetime did I think she would be the one to help me the way she did. Yeah, mate, I have not looked back. Within a few months of living here, my beautiful partner, soon to be wife, mate, she's seen how much I'd cleaned myself up, and she moved here with me. And yeah, mate, if I can fast forward from there, we've had a beautiful little baby Darcy, mate, and that's really truly set my recovery in stone, I believe. You know, and these days, mate, I thrive on helping people that have been down the same horrible path that I have, and people that want to get help. You know, in a nutshell, mate, that's pretty much my story, Ron.
Beautiful, mate. Yeah, I love the part where your mum become, you know, the shining light to show you the way, because I always say, be nice to the newcomer. He might be your sponsor one day. And people don't understand what I mean by that, you know, but it's true.
I can tell you, actually, Ron, I missed out a part that I really wanted to tell you. If you don't mind, I'm just going to rewind back a little bit. Going back to when I just got my own place and I just started to sell ice around that time. So it was, this is my story, my experience with heroin. It was a one and done thing, mate. Like it's one of the most traumatic things that's ever happened to me in my life. So I am, and you'll appreciate this being an ex-heroin addict yourself. I think the week of my 26th birthday, I'd never used the needle before, but I just started to smoke the pipe again, you know. And don't get me wrong, it's just as fucking bad as it is. My little brother, his name's Joel. It was the week of my 26th birthday, and we're both big fans of Kevin Hart, you know, the actor Kevin Hart, and he does his stand-up comedy shows and whatnot. So Joel shouted me a trip to Melbourne to watch a stand-up Kevin Hart show. You know, cut a long story short, it was a cheap trip. You know, we stayed in this little, you know, little shoebox backpackers hotel, you know, just a couple of single beds and a desk. We're both on our way to becoming ice addicts again, you know, obviously on the pipe and stuff. And we just got there. The day we got there, we're walking through the Melbourne Mall there in the city and looking for somewhere where we can buy a pipe, like a glass pipe. I'd run into this little tobacconist, whatever it was, where I bought this pipe from. And I walk back out and Joel, my brother's talking to this young lad, in the, you know, it looked like he was sort of giving my brother the shits a bit. Like he sort of, you know, he was a bit of, I thought he was just trying to bum a smoke or something like that off him. But anyway, this guy, funnily enough, was from Tassie as well, you know, and him and Joel recognised each other through playing football against each other years ago. Well, anyway, he ended up coming up to our hotel room. He had a bit of gear, when I say gear, ice on him. And he'd come back up to our hotel room and shouted us a little bit. And he was an IV user, right? So it was, and you know, my mum was deep into needle use at this point, you know? So I was like, I hate to say it, but I think knowing she was doing like, it did plant a seed in my head that maybe I wouldn't mind trying that one day, you know? We ended up sort of hanging out with this guy for most of the time, you know? Come to our last day in Melbourne, we hadn't slept or anything, you know, we'd been on the ice the whole time and we had none left and it was like the come down sort of day, you know, we were going home the next day and this guy, I won't say his name, you know, out of respect for his family, but he had this connection out Richmond way that he could get a bit of heroin off this Vietnamese guy. And I was like, oh yeah, my birthday weekend, why not? My little brother was like, you fucking idiot, Braden, why? Why? Look at mum, you know, like, I was just like, oh, fuck, whatever. I said, what if I can get you a bit of weed, you won't care? Anyway, so I went for a cruise on the tram with this young fella out to this meet this guy. And I still remember clearly this Vietnamese guy saying to this young bloke, you know, just be careful, it's good stuff. It's, yeah, it's good. It's really good stuff. And this guy said, oh, well, we're going to shoot it. And he's like, oh, well, he goes, I only smoke it. So I'm just saying, just be careful, you know. I remember that. I remember it vividly, him saying that, you know. And we were sitting on the stairs of this overpass in the dark with this guy, and I can just remember it clear as day. We proceed to come home and back to the hotel, and you know, it was a rough, I think it was about $60 a night, this little backpackers hotel, you know. It was a bit of a rough joint. You know, we're there, and this guy... So we got, I remember clear as day, we got 4 points off this guy of heroin for $100 because we went halves in it. And it was like, it was a yellow chalky sort of substance. This guy did it up. I remember he did it up in the top of in the bottom of a Coke can, you know, and melted it and whatever. And I wasn't used to none of this stuff, you know. I'd never even seen somebody shoot up in front of me before I'd met this guy. Anyway, and so... I was like, yeah, well, I'll go first. And, you know, it's a bit of a trigger warning, but I sort of held my arm out, looked away and why he did it. And, I remember, mate, it hit me that fucking hard. I remember trying to stand up and it was just, I just, like, obviously blacked out and just dizzy. It was really dizzy. It was like I couldn't stand up. I kept falling backwards. And anyway, I wake up and this is no word of a lie. Wake up and there's three paramedics standing over the top of me in this room. And, you know, in this room, there was a single bed on either side and there was, you know, a bit of flooring in between us. And I was laying down on the floor in between with these three paramedics standing over the top of me. And, you know, and they've got all the little stickers on me and stuff. And my little brother's sitting on the bed, bawling his fucking eyes out. And like, I remember just looking up to him and I felt great when I woke up, Ron. I felt amazing. I had this most euphoric feeling going through me. And I remember looking up at Joel and just laughing at him. Like, what the fuck are you crying for? What's going on? Like, why is there paramedics? What the fuck is going on? No, I'm not coming with you. Like, I'm fine. Leave me. So I didn't end up going with him. And I can't remember seeing this guy I did it with in the room at all. But my brother said he was there, but and I ended up, you know, crawling up into bed and going to sleep. Well, I woke up the next morning, mate, bang, bang, bang on the door. It was 10 a.m. and, you know, it was the guys telling us we had to check out. It was, you know, checkout time. And well, fuck, so I woke up, I was like, Joel, wake up. We've got to get out of here. There's fucking bags and there's pipes and shit everywhere. This young guy, mate, he's on the, where I was the night before, he's laying on the in between us and on the floorboards in between our two beds, and he's sort of laying there and he's got this like brown fluid running out of his mouth. And I how do I say it without sounding horrible? I didn't, last thing I thought is, oh, he's OD'd, he's dead or anything like that. I was just like, oh, I remember I even got my phone out and, like, you know, Snapchatted my mates, like, look, our mate's fucked from last night, you know. It was a, and then we proceeded to start cleaning the room up, and I was like, I'll just call him old mate. I was like, old mate, well, you know, wake up, slap him, we need to get out of here. And he wouldn't wake up, so we ended up cleaning the room up, and then it was like, for fuck's sake, like, you know, wake him up. And I remember he was laying sort of half on his belly, sort of, and I leaned over and I picked him up around the belly and sort of picked him up like that, so he was facing forward, and I was like, wake up. And then I just all hit me right. I was like, oh my god, he's cold, he's fucking dead. And I was like, fuck. And I laid him back down and I went into shock, mate, you know. Like, me being the big brother, you would have thought that I would have been the one, you know. But my little brother was a, mind you, he was 21 at this age, this stage, same as this young guy, 21 years old. And I stood there like a fucking stunned mullet, mate, and watched my little brother try and revive this guy, mouth to mouth, pumping his chest, you know, with the ambulance on loudspeaker, with the phone next to his head, mate. You know, he's got all this fluid coming up off his lungs and it's going in my brother's mouth, and it was fucking horrific. And I just stood there in shock. I just froze. I didn't know what to do. And, you know, the ambulance and the police and stuff ended up coming. And, he was pronounced dead the next day. It was definitely something that my brother and I will, you know, have till the day we die. But it was, that was my experience with heroin, Ron. It was fucking not good.
Yeah, no.
But it was 2 points. 2 points we'd had each and one hit. So it was, I mean, I spoke to Denny Shannon about it and he said, mate, you're a fucking idiot. You know, 2 points will drop anybody. Like,
Yeah, especially if you've never used it, you know. And that's a warning to anyone who's listening to this podcast, you know. You don't have to be a full-fledged junkie for many years to die. You know, you can die in your first shot. And everybody that dies on a shot of any drug, they've got no understanding or understanding or belief that they're going to die on that shot. I say it all the time. The people that died today from drug use had plans for tomorrow.
Exactly. You know,
so it's really important that the listeners of this program understand that, and we're all one shot away from being a junkie. That's why I don't use. And we're all one shot away from being dead. You know, don't think, oh, it can't happen to me, because it happens to everybody. You know, it happens to, when I say it happens to everybody that died didn't think it was going to happen to them. You know, over the 42 years I've been around, mate, you can imagine how many people I know that have passed away. You know, I've turned to people's houses and people are dead on the couch, and everyone else is asleep. They don't even know he's dead. And the same deal, you look at them and they're blue and it's like, oh God, you know, another one, another one.
And that's what my little brother was saying to me. My brother's there and he's pumping his chest and, you know, giving him the mouth and that, and then looking around at me saying, this is what I was fucking doing to you last night. You know, this is why I fuck, you know, and that's my little brother, you know. I'm 5 years older than him. It's like, so I was, apparently I was gone for about 10 to 15 minutes and then I came back myself, so.
Yeah, it's a putrid. Look, all drug addiction's putrid. You know why? I'll tell you why. Because it steals away the joy of your life for you and everybody else that's connected to you, you know what I mean? And that's why I love recovery, because recovery has also got that same ripple effect. By us staying off drugs, it helps everybody else around us, you know? My whole purpose in life today is to carry a message and to be of service to other people. That's why we do this podcast. You know, I don't do this podcast for any other reason but to try to carry a message of recovery to the person who still suffers. And not only people who suffers, but people that never been in addiction, they have family members or friends or you know, associates, work buddies, and don't judge them. Just have a little bit of an open mind and think, why are they using? Why, you know, there's, there's a reason those people are using, you know, and don't give up because, you know, I was voted most likely not to get clean in a rehab of 120 people. I'm 38 years clean in a couple of weeks.
You know, wow, mate. I was voted.
Yeah. I was voted the one who would never get clean. That was the that's quite a funny thing to be voted that and then turn out to be the one that did get clean, you know?
Yeah, 100%.
Mate, look, it's been really a pleasure having you on the show, mate, and I hope that some of our listeners get something out of it, which I'm sure they do. Please understand, none of us glorify using drugs. We're here to tell you that only losers use drugs. You know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely.
I believe being a gangster is looking after your family, putting food on the table and all that
stuff. Exactly,
you know?
Mate.
We aren't who we were. That's our lessons, so we don't have to go back to there again, you know. And every single day to me is Christmas. Every day I wake up and I don't use drugs is Christmas. You know, people say to me, what did you do for Christmas? I said, the same as I do every day. Rejoiced and enjoyed it, you know what I mean? And I'm an extremely grateful recovering addict, alcoholic, who believes that no matter what drug you use, you're robbing yourself of the joy of life.
100%, mate. Exactly right. You know, it's such a horrible thing, addiction, you know, and a lot of people, majority of people don't understand the meaning of addiction. It's, you know, you've got to live it to understand it, I believe, or be at least a loved one of an addict to witness or to understand it, you know, because it's an evil thing and it is a sickness. It's not a choice. I mean, it's probably a choice at the beginning. But you know, but it's not, once you're addicted, mate, it's a sickness. It really is. It's definitely not a choice.
Like, until we get help, until we get information, we don't have a choice. But once you stop using, then you become responsible and you have a choice, you know?
Definitely right, mate. 100%.
Yeah. Today, my choice is that I don't put one in my body because I know if I put one in my body, I can't stop.
Yeah.
And I never tell anybody you can't use. What I say is that you can't use and have a good life.
Yeah, that's right. Yep.
We can all use. You know what I mean? Fuck me. Then I can get on. I got money in the bank. I can go and score. You know, and I walk in any major city, you'll get on within an hour. Walk in any bar, you'll be on in 20 minutes, you know?
It doesn't matter
where I go anywhere in the world, I can score. But it's my choice not to go to those places. And no, mate, you're doing good stuff, and you know it's been a pleasure to having you on The Truth About Addiction.
It was an honour, mate. It really was. It was, I really appreciate your phone call, mate. And honestly, Ronnie, I'll really look forward to having you on my show too, mate.
Mate, I look forward to it. The last question, Joe, was ask: what is your future dreams, aspirations, desires? If I said you can do anything you want, and you can't fail, what would you do?
Look, mate, I'm just blessed to be in recovery, Ron. You know, I'm not one of these guys that is going to say, my future is to, you know, live in a penthouse, high-rise apartment and drive a Lamborghini, mate, because that's all materialistic shit, mate. You know, my aspirations and goals are to live a long and healthy, happy, loving life with my beautiful family. I hope to put another little one out there shortly, so I'll have four kids, hopefully. I'm happy to be in recovery. I mean, if I can give any advice to anybody as well, that maybe starting their ICE journey, it's, look, just fucking listen to people like ourselves. There's that many warning signs out there. I mean, for why you shouldn't do it, you know, name one reason why you should. There isn't any. Wake up to yourself, seriously. There's no life in it, and that goes for using and drug dealing. You know, I was a drug dealer for a lot of years, mate, and it's the same deal with that. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when you're going to get caught.
No, I agree, mate. It's soulless. I like being who I am today. I like being a human being. When I'm using, I'm a human taking. When I'm a drug dealer, I'm a human taking. I'm not a human being. Today I'm a human being, you know, and I say this sincerely. As long as I give more than I take, I'm being a human being, you know?
100%, so,
mate,
yeah.
Raiden, thank you very much for the truth about addiction, mate. It's been a pleasure having you on the show, and we'll keep in contact, brother.
Thanks, Ronnie. I appreciate it, mate.
I solemnly swear that I will tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So help me God.